the question is about when you're dealing with the in a situation where you have an opportunity to be of service, no matter how selflessly you hold your head, you still want something out of it, even if it's just wanting the other person to benefit. So how do you really separate that from the process? And I don't know that you really can, or that it's necessary. It's putting a really fine line on it, like that there's no requirement that we be perfect about this or anything. It's just that, you know, I would just suggest that the direction is away from personal gratification from service, which is, that's 99% of the, I mean, if you're down to the point where your biggest problem is wanting the other person to gain a benefit, then you're already pretty pure in your motivations. And 99% of the people that are engaged in what might be charitable or service work are probably doing it because that's the self-image they want. They want the self-image as a good person. They want a self-image as someone who does things for other people. They want a self-image as a giver. And for that, they need someone who's a receiver. And so if you get past that point, you're already really pure in your motivations. Now, a much purer state is that you just don't even really perceive that there's any service going on at all. You perceive no giver. You perceive no service. Someone would have to tell you afterwards, hey, you really helped that person. I did? What did I do? You weren't even aware of it. It just is something that arises naturally because people who come into your sphere just naturally benefit from being with you because you're not asking anything of them and you're not trying to get anything out of the situation and you don't even have a thought for trying to give them something you think they need. It's a very pure and organic situation where everybody gets what they need because nobody's trying to take more than they should from the situation. But you're already in pretty good shape if all you want is for the other person to get something good out of it.
I mean, I essentially just base it on the benefit being something else or someone else as opposed to myself.
Right.
And then that's where I kind of determine, okay, well, then I'm on the right path.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's still about them.
Right. It's still about them. And then there's just other aspects that we just need to be aware of. We don't need to beat ourselves up about it if we find it in our psyche that these things are in there. But we need to be honest about why we're doing things, not just in this, but in everything. Why am I really doing this? You know, what's in it for me? And so that's an area where there's some pitfalls and opportunities for self-delusion about what we're up to.
When Rose talked about, I think it's somewhat of an important distinction, when I said this quote about make yourself a service and you'll be taken care of, I consider it to be different than service work as a practice. Basically, and I feel like when Rose says make yourself of service, there's more of a between this element to it. And I don't know, I can't talk too much about it, but I feel like that is something of a distinction.
Right, right. No, I agree. There is a between this aspect to it when you kind of just, you take yourself out of the formula. You know, it becomes obvious that, hey, this is something that only I can do, therefore I'm going to do it. You know, if it happens that other people benefit from it, fine. You know, but this has obviously come up in my life, and so I'm just going to go ahead and do it. Right. Just step into it without reservation because it's so organically obvious that this is something that you need to be doing.
I was going to say just about the same thing, that between this aspect of service, service is the wrong word, we know what we're talking about, and to use that between this, and then just let the chips fall where they do, you know, including the difference. But it's like, you know, how Ed said, we're like a seeker, you reach a point, seekers, where there's nothing else to do. There's nothing else to do. And maybe with service, even without calling it service, you reach a point, there's nothing else to do. And then there's no real self, there's no altruism anymore.
Yeah, it's important to, when we talk about taking yourself out of the formula, I mean all the way out of the formula. I literally, that you know, there's no limit to what can be accomplished if you don't care who gets the credit. And if you're just really nothing in it for you, you don't care if anybody ever knows anything, that thought didn't even cross your mind, that you should ever be known as a person who, you know, provides service. That's not even in there. You're completely everything's just completely anonymous and natural and organic. This just becomes your way of being, essentially.
Yeah, and you said it's actually better if no one knows, even the person, you know?
Right.
And I guess I could say, yeah, for me, if I didn't know either, then it'd be fine.
And you don't know. You might think you're doing somebody a service, and you didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and you might have no clue that you just did somebody the greatest service of their life. So it's just a thought that follows that, you know, it's the thoughts about it are extraneous anyway.
The question I had was on the manifesting mind.
Yes.
It's a little hard. You know?
The whole thing is hard. You know?
But then when you said after, you know, that you said this, and then you said, like, another way of saying it maybe was the portal between the source and creation, and you are that. That's the manifesting mind. Well, to take that statement and to like make it like an action thing, like a verb, maybe even with service, well, is there something that could be done there?
I wouldn't try to mix them.
Okay.
The idea of looking back into what you're looking out of identifying the closest point that you can, capital H here, finding that and resting in it, is a completely different focus than worrying about who's being of service in the manifestation.
That is the verb, then, to rest in that space.
Sure. Just find it. Just find it. Just look for it. You know, it's not out there. This is the direction. You know, and the closer you can arrive at the point of closeness, the close realm, sometimes I talk about, locate the close realm, and then get even closer, and then get even closer. What you're looking for is the closest point that you can identify of what you think is you.
Like the Sufis said, closer to you than your juggler
being. Absolutely. So that's the direction. And when we talk about service and everything, that's all happening out here.
Right.
But you also had said that, you know, one of the goals was keeping your head over it. So, you know, I think that's the most difficult aspect of, you know, keeping your head over it. All the distractions, everything. So.
I know. Keeping your head on it. I mean, that's why I think it's so powerful. Because, and it's really all you have to do. Because there's no right or wrong way to do this stuff. You know, there's no perfect path. There's no perfect book to read. There's no perfect teacher to listen to. But if it's always in your mind that you're always looking for something that's going to get you one step closer to this fortunate accident, you know, if you're sort of parsing all of the events of your life and all of the thoughts that pass through based on that, that's the parsing mechanism, is how does this relate to my grandest goal, you might say, and you're always thinking that way, things will naturally fall into place. But it's difficult.
How did you get to that point?
Okay. I don't think I ever did. Until maybe really close to the end, when it became, quite honestly, almost a life and death issue. It reaches a point, you know, and this is not necessarily a message that, you know, draws audiences, but it reaches a point of pain that life really isn't worth much without it. And Rose used to talk about, you know, you can get yourself kind of close with all of these practices and, you know, keeping your head on everything. And then at some point, through your own efforts and through minor aspects of grace, you reach a point where the vortex is stronger than you are. Your resistance to the vortex is lessened. Life is not pulling you backwards anymore as much. And then the vortex takes over and it happens. So we can approach the precipice and then hope a big wind comes up and blows us over. And I think often one aspect of the final act of this sort of thing is that you really do lose interest in life without it. Doesn't mean you're going to put the gun in your mouth or anything, but life just doesn't have anything to seduce you with anymore. You realize that your deepest dreams for success and happiness in the material world could manifest, and it wouldn't matter. You would not be moved by them. But that's something that you can't try to manufacture on purpose. It's a gradualism, and in my case, very gradual. It took a lot of years, you know, so I wouldn't recommend my approach. You know, it was pretty scattered, and I did a lot of other things in those years. You know, raise a family and have a job and all those normal things, and I had the desires that went with that. Make more money, successful kids or whatever, you know. There's all sorts of mini desires thrown into living a normal life. And I was by no means a pure seeker, a very flawed seeker, as a matter of fact, probably why it took 37 years. So I'd recommend a more direct path. But the process for keeping your head on is basically just sort of reminding. It's a constant reminder. You know, you do things that tend to keep your head on it. Go to a weekly meeting. Pick up, you know, have the books that are most visible to you in your bedroom are books that are on the subject, you know, not the latest novel or something. Just sort of little tips or tricks and techniques that you do to remind yourself, oh, yeah, you know. But for everybody, it's different, and it's really difficult because the world is constantly pulling you in the other direction. Oops, I should have done that. The world is constantly pulling you in the other direction. It's seducing you, saying, you know, come hither, you know. I have one more, you know, piece of glitz that you might like.
What do you mean when you say the truth is in you?
Where does truth live?
What?
Where is it? Where's the house of truth?
I
know.
Answer. I want to know, what do you mean?
The question is, Sunil is talking about, you know, when you talk about approaching truth and the drift is, the direction is within, and he says his mind is trying to find a place in your mind where truth resides, you know, and I guess implied in that question is that where it lives? You know, is there a part of the mind in which truth is hiding? And the short answer is no. That the mind, you know, is a manifestation of the dream just like everything else. And realization does not include the mind. The mind is not present. And so in the aftermath, one of the things that happens is the mind scrambles to catch up, and it wants to be in on the action. Oh, what happened? You know, how can I explain this to myself? Let's find some words for this. Let's put it into my paradigm now. And as soon as it does that, it immediately is now in untruth again. It can't be understood by the mind. Even the mind of the robot that went into the occurrence, as soon as that mind will come up with words and stand behind a podium and try to, you know, talk about it, but that in no way implies that mind has any knowing. There's been no knowing imparted to me. I used to know things, and now I don't know anything. So it's the truth is not just a higher aspect of mind. Mind cannot approach it in any way and cannot apprehend it. It's not just that it can't comprehend it. It can't apprehend it. It's like asking a microwave to give television images or something. The wiring is just not there. So when we talk about manifested and unmanifested mind, it's not quite the same discussion. That's just pointing a direction in which mind is no longer in the formula. It's mind as we think of it when we talk about mind is all manifested mind. We don't know anything but manifested mind. Unmanifested mind, you could say, is no mind, would be another way of talking about it. And it quite literally, I think, whether you want to accept this metaphor or not, it quite literally is what you never see,
no matter where you look.
It's that close. That's the source of all. I mean, every time we think, I mean, I know for my entire path, people would talk about the absolute or truth or something like that, and it was always out there somewhere, probably in very distant reaches. You could travel to it and approach it, or, you know, and it was complete opposite. It's the closest, most intimate thing imaginable, and it blows right past any concept of mind or understanding. And so all of that is part of this. Everything you can possibly think about mind, everything you can possibly think about God, all concepts, all perceptions, everything is out there. And none of it is true. And so this is the way you go to, you can't even say it's to find what's true, but to arrive at a place where truth is irrelevant. Source. It's just source, which is nothingness, total unmanifested nothingness, projects creation through a portal which identifies itself as a separate entity. And that's. I'll just stop there.
In your account of realization, you had mentioned that it was a starting revelation, but at the same time, you had always known. When you realized, you had always known. What does that mean exactly?
That doesn't really make sense, does it? I won't repeat that one because I think that was loud enough. But it can't be imagined beforehand. The imagination can't come up with it. Mind can't. Nothing that we read in books or hear from teachers or anything prepares us for it. And so in that regard, it's startling and unexpected, and any other kind of word that you might, any other synonym for that you might throw at it. At the same time, what's discovered is so obvious and self-evident and always been. There's never been a time when it wasn't. And so all of that crescendos at the same time. So and it also obliterates all sense of past, all sense of never having known. In other words, it completely wipes out your past of, I can't remember when this wasn't the case. I have no concept of before and after. This is just how it's always been. And so there's that intimate familiarity that comes at the same time. It's a, of course, you know, it's my whole life I've been looking for this while I've been looking for my glasses while I was wearing them. You know, oh, here they are.
Yeah. It's easy to interpret that as a seeker that I know right now.
But does that does it do you any good to intellectually toy with that idea? It just doesn't. I mean, the highest and most profound truth can be voiced, and it's useless to us, absolutely useless to us on an intellectual level. It's just more misinformation. But enough of those things maybe begins to put the mind on shaky ground. We're no longer, and this gets into the doubt everything kind of procedure. I think maybe that's what the process of seeking is to undermine everything that we think we're standing on. And if we're successful in putting the mind on shaky ground, and these kinds of concepts, even just held intellectually, tend to do that. You know, you give them a little bit of credence, and then, you know, a little bit, kind of tends to prove out in your life a little bit. You get a glimpse, you get some sort of an epiphany that might be true, you know, or something. The mind starts to be a little less certain about stuff, you know, and the shakier ground the mind is on, the more likely an accident will happen. So that's the process, to become unsure of everything that you thought you knew. Whereas instinctively we think, well, I'm going to become more sure of what's true. I'll just add on a lot of spiritual knowledge, and you know, if I get enough of it, you know, I'll reach a critical mass, and that last little bit will be added unto me. But nothing is added unto you. You know, everything is taken away. And so whatever degree that you can start to approximate that in your search by allowing things to fall away, backing away from untruth and putting yourself on shaky ground, you set yourself up for something that might happen.
Taking off from where I left off, before your experience, were you aware that you weren't the mind? Did you get to the point where you thought you were a separate awareness watching the mind process? And then, and if so, how does that relate to you no thought in your in the betweenness formula, since that would tend to be perhaps opposite thought?
The question has to do with prior to a final realization. Could you say that again, Phil? I'm sorry.
Well, were you a separate, did you believe yourself to be a separate awareness that was watching the mind from that perspective?
Prior to realization, do you believe yourself to be a separate awareness that's watching the mind? And that's a practice. You know, I experienced that as a practice where I would experiment with that and test the waters and try to move backwards to an ever more anterior observer. And I think that's a great practice, and especially a great first step to at least cut that cord between this ridiculous actor that's out here making a fool of himself every day and something that watches that character. So at least separate, make that first step that you're aware of what the character's doing, and then see what other kinds of observers might be there. Ultimately, there's no observer. You know, they're all the observers are just, you know, different aspects of the one demon, the identity. But, you know, if your question is, did I have any experiences of that jarred me, I'd probably have to say no. I don't know if that was your question or not. But all of those sorts of thought experiments and mind experiments for me were a practice that were inconclusive. Is that what you were getting at?
Well, yeah, and why I was saying that a seeker could get to that point and believe that that's it, that's the end of the road.
I can't speak for anybody else, but that's possible, I suppose. But I think that always, if self-honesty is a part of the process, which that's why it's so important, self-honesty and self-inquiry, to keep looking at it. If someone were to arrive at a point of a lesser amazement, say, and say, I'm done, then life may challenge that. You know, well, if you're done, why are you still reading spiritual books? If you're done, why do you have some questions? If you're done, why do you still experience this or that? You know, or why is this still in your life? I think very quickly life would present you with situations where you go, you know what, I'm not done. Something still needs to happen. So self-honesty is always there, as in everything else. If somebody says to me, you know, I had a final realization, my questions are gone and I'm done, I believe them. You know, that to me says it all. At that point, a person has no interest in spiritual books or teachers. As a matter of fact, the books and the teachers, no matter how ancient or how name brand they are now, answer to you. You look at those books and you look at those words and you decide how close they came to the truth. You're not looking to those words for truth. You say, oh, came pretty close, but this is misleading. You know, if you change this phrase, it would now sound better, and that sort of thing. You become the final authority on all of it. And so until that happens, you know, there's something else needs to happen.
And I guess I ask a two-part question.
So no, go ahead.
Where is the no thought in the formula that you mentioned between this and as being opposite of thought?
I'll for the purpose of the conversation, I'll retreat to my four aspects that I identified so I could talk about it, which was, the question was, where does no thought fit into the betweenness formula? And the aspects that I identified that sort of helped me understand or get my head around this very nebulous concept of betweenness are intention, confidence, gratitude, and indifference. And intention is like that initial desire. You know, it's the sine qua non, without which nothing. If you don't have a desire, nothing's going to happen. You have to have a focused intention, whether it's to get a certain card in poker or to, you know, get $1 million or enlightened or whatever it is. That intention has to be present for the mechanism to even start to operate. And then the confidence aspect, you could call that like faith. Along with that intention, there has to be a degree, and probably a pretty high degree, that that it's going to happen. You know, you have a certain confidence in it, you know, a very casual faith that, yeah, you know, this is, you know, I want it, so done deal. It's going to happen. The gratitude aspect is, but if it doesn't, you know, I'm grateful for everything that I have right now, just as it is. This is what I want, but I'm in love with what is. This is perfect just as it is. Within that perfection, I'd like this as well. So that's right there, to have a desire and a gratitude for a world without that desire being fulfilled. That says a mouthful about betweenness right there, which is where the indifference comes in. You literally don't care if your desire is fulfilled or not. And that's where no thought comes in. You cease to have a thought about your desire or any process about it. You just forget it. It's out there. It's going to happen. I love the world just the way it is, whether it happens or not. I'm done. No thought.
When you say no thought, are you talking about no conceptual thought?
No conceptual thought. And that's where it gets a little confusing, because just really the state of no thought would, of course, have no concepts, would have nothing to do with the betweenness, would have nothing to do with anything you want in the material world or beyond. Really, the state of no thought is, in its purest form, you have disappeared. You know, when there's no thought present, you're not present. If it's really no thought, nobody's there.
Is that oblivion?
You tell me. Yeah. It depends on how you define oblivion. I wouldn't say it wasn't. I mean, you're absolutely untethered in infinite emptiness and perfectly safe at the same time.
That sounds like Tolle's now.
Well, yeah. What else is there? It's now. Well, no thought is now without the dream.
So the idea of indifference and ultimate betweenness, Luke wanting truth, but then being indifferent toward that and grateful for life and loving everything as it is part of that loving life and everything as it is, well, I've made a decent life for myself, so I can't be ungrateful, or is it like, I live on a park bench and I have a terrible life, but somehow I've arrived at a place of genuine gratitude for it? Because it just seems like that could also then, as one is seeking, that could play into hedging your bets, so to speak.
Yeah, this is where you get into the area of how much betweenness can really be manufactured. You know, if you really say, oh, I'm going to really master betweenness. You know, I'm not quite sure how that's done. Like I say, I never really even understood it or consciously practiced it. So most of what I have to say about it is looking back at that final act, that epilogue of my life before the flight from Harding's workshop. And what manifested there, how that played out. And the way it played out was that going to the Harding workshop was the culmination of a last-ditch effort to have this happen before the Marble Orchard. You know, I mean, I was getting older, and, you know, Rose had said early on in the group, you know, if it doesn't happen by the age of 30, you know, you hang up the spurs. And then the group aged out of the 30 bracket, and he says, well, if it doesn't happen by the age of 40. He never went beyond that, as far as I know, though. So I was getting a little nervous. You know, quite honestly, one of the I don't mean to go too far afield here, but I think one of the things that helped a lot for me was having some friends and peers have the experience. It brought it out of the realm of something that was for extraordinary people, you know, name brand teachers from centuries ago, or an extraordinary person like Rose, into the realm of you know, irresponsible assholes like me. You know, and I had proof that it could happen to these folks. And you know, and Art was the final straw. Yes. Yeah, guy's 2 years older than me, you know. Pops a circuit, you know.
What you forgot to mention is when Douglas Harding said to you, my dear, dear friend.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
But
you couldn't help but be affected by that.
I know, yeah.
Such an amazement.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, my trip to see Harding was part of this last-ditch effort, you know. Buy a plane ticket and cross the ocean and give this thing, you know, a final shot. And so, as I was saying, leading up to that was this almost life and death feeling that was had a little side thought of hopelessness. You know, I'm making this, you know, heroic last stand, at least in my own mind, kind of thing. At the same time, feeling absolutely hopeless that anything was going to happen. But the desire was there, and there was. I mean, I was like a little two-year-old. You know, basically, I was demanding of God. You know, I said, "Okay, so, you know, you've given me a nice life and some spiritual insights to a degree and that sort of thing. I want a conclusive experience that, once and for all, puts a stake in the ground that a before and after and whatever I thought." And so I'm going over there, and this is my mentality as I go into the workshop. And what happened was, during the course of the workshop, that started to drop away for whatever reason. I don't know. I literally fell in love with the people in the workshop. I've always been kind of a judgmental person, and I, you know, I take one look at somebody and I size them up and I put them in a pigeonhole and I know, you know, who and what they are and that sort of thing. And sometimes I can judge harshly and that sort of thing. I did the same thing when I got to the workshop. You know, I sized everybody up and put them in their appropriate pigeonholes and everything, and you know, within hours and a couple of period, the days, I was there for 4 days, everything fell away, and I just fell in love with every single person that was there for just who they were, and I didn't even know who they were. I didn't care. I had no judgments about them whatsoever. There was just, and Harding was a central force in this because he's such a loving person. As Art says, you know, he meets you for the first time, and it's like, you know, he's greeting a long-lost brother or something. You know, it's just this love exudes from him. So, and I, you know, talked later about this. Really, I think the self started to dissolve then, you know, before anything happened. Where it was just this beautiful world with these beautiful people in it. And then a few other things happened at the workshop, and then as I was leaving, saying goodbye to Harding, he just kind of went, "Simplify!" Bye. I wasn't taking a plane till the next day, and so Augie Manger was there. We were there together at the workshop. And I went up to my room after that and just sat in a chair and I think arrived at a state of no thought. It was just kind of... And about a half hour later, I just had this wrenching cry that was just torn from me. And some kind of a dam burst, some sort of a surrender happened. And I not only gave up the idea of a realization, but I was glad of it. I really, honestly, was totally indifferent to whether it ever happened. You can't scam it. You can't fake it out. It just absolutely left. I no longer had the desire. And was absolutely immensely grateful for the world in my life just as it was. As a matter of fact, I felt like a real asshole for wanting so much and for wanting more when I'd been given so much already. And so the gratitude was just spontaneous. And with that brought an absolute indifference that any desire that I might have, whether it be enlightenment or anything else, an absolute indifference to whether it ever happened. I was free. And if nothing happened, had happened on the plane, I was, you know, I think my life would have still been different in some way because I was free of it. The next morning I woke up and the world was a perfect world. I walked out the cathedral. We were at Salisbury, and the Salisbury Cathedral was bathed in the morning sun. It was absolutely, literally gold. You know, everywhere was flowers, beautiful flowers. The taxi cab driver was like my best friend in the world. It was just everything was like, you know, and I got on the plane. The plane takes off, and just looking out at these beautiful clouds. I tried to read, actually. I brought out a book of Harding's out of my backpack and tried to read, and quite literally, I don't know how else to say it, but reading didn't happen. Those marks on the page did not add up to anything. It just did not. So I'm just very, put it back. And it's okay, no reading. And then sometime after that, what I had been a two-year-old pounding my fist for happened when completely unbidden. So that that experience is what I base all of the things I say about betweenness basically derived from that series of events, and identifying that as what Rose meant by ultimate betweenness. Now, how I could have manufactured that or worked towards it prior to that thing, those things sort of being torn from me, I have no idea. But the principle became absolutely apparent to me in retrospect as I look at how that series of events unfolded.
The second or third day, he said, it felt like everything was so beautiful, you already had everything.
I didn't think of it as having anything.
Oh, okay.
I don't mean to correct you while you're asking your question, but...
No, he said, I felt like an asshole wanting more, or wanting something.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what you
mean? Just for being so ungrateful. You know, it was the opposite of gratitude that I had been embracing my whole life. I had been living a life as an ingrate, regardless of the blessings that had been granted to me. All I was saying was, "I want more," and not just in a spiritual aspect, but in every aspect of my life. More, 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 bigger, better, more. Me, me, me. And to be fair to myself, you know, I have moments of gratitude certainly, and but. An unshakable state of gratitude had never been my experience, where no matter what happened, park bench, death, painful disease, you know, would not affect a state of unconditional gratitude. And so you can't manufacture that, and you say, I'm going to go for that. But that state of unconditional gratitude, when it appears in your life, is a launching pad for some very magical events.
There really is no end. It's a constant, infinite seeking that we're on that path of seeking and knowing and finding out. And that is the goal. And that is the purpose. Be on that path.
The goal is to be on an infinite path?
Right. And that to try and find the end is really the problem. And this is kind of, I'm kind of seeing that, I don't want to like try to put you down or anything, but I see that where you're saying more, 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 because you're actually looking for the end.
I was.
And
I wanted to be put out of my misery.
The truth is, it's not, there isn't an end. It's an infinite path of seeking. And at the end, we won't find out. We don't have, not at this point. And maybe, I don't know how it's phrased, but when we do find out what the end is, but we're not here to convey it.
But if it's an infinite, how are you going to find out?
Right, we won't. At least I don't.
What are you doing here?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm throwing that out there.
You wandered into the wrong meeting, I think.
Yeah. But I'm kind of trying to find out why you continuously search. Because
I eventually came to the conclusion after going down a lot of circuitous paths along the way in 37 years, like I say, of not knowing what I was looking for, but just having a vague idea that there was something more than this, be it spiritual adventure, be it, you know, whatever, that there was something more than I was currently experiencing, and being confused about what that might be for a lot of years. I met Richard Rose, and being with him and being convinced that his experience was genuine and that there was a possibility to receive, for a final answer to make itself known, to put it literally, to put me out of my misery, to put an end to seeking, not an end to existence, not an end to, you know, even the dream, or even the, as it turns out, or even to the character, even the dream character survives. He's dethroned, but he's not destroyed. So it's not an end in an ultimate sense, but it's an end of seeking. The questions that had plagued me for so many years disappeared. And somewhere along the way, I got the idea that that was possible. And I think that's maybe in some ways step one. You know, until you internalize that that's a possibility, it's pretty hard to desire it. But I think Buddha talked about that too, that, and I call it being bit by the snake, you know, that the possibility that there is an end to this questioning, the end of the confusion. The end. It doesn't mean you get answers. You don't get smarter. You don't have this huge storehouse of wisdom or anything. It's the exact opposite of that, actually. But, and of course, we understand it imperfectly. But all we really need to understand, or all we really get at that point, is something real could happen to me in this lifetime. You know, while this body is still alive, it could become something other than I'm currently experiencing. There is a different way of being possible. And like I say, you know, Rose was my first personal example of that. And I was very fortunate to have several friends have something happen. And, you know, I'm a tough nut. You know, it takes a lot of sledgehammers to get through to me. And I think I probably needed these examples that this is something that really can happen to just an ordinary schlump. And, you know, I knew these guys before and after. And I observed the change. It was invaluable to me, I think, to have it brought into the realm where even an unworthy, ignorant person like me could be saved. And all along the way, it became more and more of a possibility. You know, it's not just a vague intellectual idea that exists out there with thousands of others. It began to be more and more the only idea, the only solution. Even if it didn't turn out to be true, it was my only hope. Was that something like this existed and was possible. That was my only hope. Nothing else was going to do it. And certainly not a concept that it's infinitely endless to exist in this state of confusion and pain. That certainly wasn't going to do me any good. That would get me nowhere. That would be a prescription for endless, infinite confusion and pain. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. Is it useful? Is that a useful idea? Where can you ride that? Where does that train take you? Even if it's not true, I'll get on a train that I've investigated to the point where it looks like there's a good possibility that these people are telling the truth.
Bart, when you're saying more and more and more, is that perhaps a paradoxical statement of deeper, deeper, or more real, something like that?
Yeah, I was just being kind of flippant with that. On every level of my life, I think I've always wanted more. You know, more money, more women, more comfort, more success, you know, whatever. You know, it's just, that's how we're programmed, you know, and I was aware of that in myself. And so it also was that way in the spiritual search was, I've been, you know, blessed with a lot of things that came up during those 37 years that, you know, kind of said, okay, you're on the right track, and, you know, here's a little glimpse, you know, now keep going or whatever, you know. But I was never, it didn't do it. It kind of gets back to Phil's question, I guess. You know, without a final conclusive experience that removes all questions, you know, I wasn't satisfied. You know, thank you, but that's not it, you know.
So you're saying it wasn't a finality.
Right, it didn't provide any finality. And I didn't know if a finality was possible, even though I had friends that, you know, had something happen and trusted that Rose was who he said he was. And Nisargadatta, you know, I devoured I Am That. And, you know, lots of other books along the way, Maharshi and everybody and all these people that are saying the same thing. And, you know, even then, that doesn't mean that it's true. You know, that's still just a lot of people saying something, you know, that I had not experienced. It didn't change my life in any way, you know. So give me something I can use here, you know. Convince me. And maybe we need to do that, you know, demand to be convinced. Because maybe if we don't, you know, whoever's listening says, okay, he's going to be satisfied with something less, so let him have something less. So maybe we have to have that, you know, little kid inside us demanding a final answer, or we won't be satisfied. You know, I'm going to hold my breath until I turn blue. And so let's have it. But that just that general programming to want more and to be dissatisfied, that, you know, dissatisfaction. If you're not dissatisfied, you're not going to move in any direction of satisfaction. So, and then the point of a spiritual search is to channel that dissatisfaction into a direction that may prove fortunate on a spiritual level.
Something there about discerning the difference between compulsively orienting around a prospect of finality versus intuitively sensing.
Elaborate just a little bit.
The thing about not postulating, and this just goes back to that, not postulating that, you know, oh, these guys are online, it's definitely.
Right.
I'm going there. You know, I can't see it right now, but I'm going there.
You have to doubt everything. Like I say, you know, that's part of it. You know, I guess what I was saying is, you know, okay, you sent me a lot of books and a lot of people that are saying the same thing, but hey, how about me? You know, I'm not convinced until you give me hard evidence. You know, if you say you've cracked a lot of other nuts, how about cracking this nut? You know, then we'll evaluate what's up with it.
Did you doubt the one that wanted the answers?
That's an interesting question. Doubt his existence or doubt?
Doubt that it was valid. Doubt that it was...
To want it? Doubt that what I was looking for was...
I've noticed in my experience on more, I guess, grosser states of desiring realization.
Doubt the seeker?
Doubt that you really want it?
Doubt the purity of the motive.
Well, doubt the doubter. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's... I mean, really, it just gets back to doubt everything. If you have a question about doubt, go in favor of doubt until you've got hard evidence. I mean, basically, we're on all levels, we live our life based on assumptions and beliefs that have no foundation. And so just because we get put ourselves on a spiritual search, it doesn't mean that suddenly all the things that come into our awareness of a spiritual nature are immune from that. You know, they should get even harder doubt because we're dealing with some serious stuff here. So you can't take anybody's word for anything. You can't take your own word. You doubt your own mind. You doubt your own motivations. You doubt your self-honesty. You doubt everything about yourself. Nothing's immune. And your motives are not going to be pure. You know, don't worry about your motives being pure. They'll never be pure. And that's fine. They will, by the process, life will purify them to a degree for you as you proceed. But you can't intentionally try to purify them, really. You can focus your desire, but you can't really purify your motives. They're on a different, they take place on a different level. And it's okay to have impure motives. It's okay to want it for personal gain. That doesn't really matter, I don't think. You can want it for very superficial reasons. Those reasons will be refined along the way. But anything, any carrot on the stick is fair game.
Something that you say in hindsight, I mean, you can't think along the way if you become aware that you have a motive. I think maybe this is more of what you're asking. Like, if you have a motive that you detect in your seeking that you doubt, then you're inherently gonna, you know, I mean, you can't go, oh, well, Bart says, okay, to have bad motives.
Don't do anything based on what Bart says. Right there, that's.
That?
Don't do anything based on what Bart says. Let's start with that. I just think that anything that gets your butt in the chair at a meeting like this, anything that makes you pick up a book of a spiritual nature, anything that makes you dissatisfied with life as it is now being lived in your space is a perfectly good reason to look for something better. And I don't judge the motives. I think, you know, I've had as many impure motives in 37 years as a person could have for wanting this to happen. I don't think I ever had a pure motive. It's always going to be personal. It's always going to be you want something out of it. You don't do this unless you want something out of it. You know, like I say, you know, nobody gets into this business because they want to discover that they don't exist. You know, that's not a good motive. It will not get you out of bed. So anything that does, anything that gets you moving, you know, I give it carte blanche. And I think the desire, you know, is much more important than the motive, just an intensity of desire. Because the world, the universe, God, however you want to envision it, wants to give you what you want. That's how it's wired. It wants to give you what you want. And so the process is to refine desires, focus intent, focus desire. And it's hard to do on purpose, but you live your life in such a way by keeping your head on it that desire becomes implicit in a lot of things that you do. And it's not that you voice it, but your actions echo that constantly. You're constantly showing whatever might be watching that that's what you want most. Because that's what you're doing most. And it doesn't care what you're thinking while you're doing it. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.